traditional basis of farming?
We have lots of seed growers in the valley, actually. And we are not on the land that we're talking about, especially on some of the seed farms. They're not big farms. They're small, little plots of land, and they're clean land because this area in particular is in the seed farms. We need the cleanest land possible to have the purest seed. And so it wasn't traditionally big agricultural land. It was dairy farms, and that's why we still are able to have this clean land here. And we feel like it's our responsibility to preserve this land and keep it clean.
Now, unlike Josephine County, which is pretty mountainous, I guess you actually have really good soil. This is like the Rogue River Valley and then some of the smaller rivers like Applegate?
Yeah, and part of Josephine County has wonderful soil as well, and they're working to preserve their right to farm how they want to as well.
And this as an aside, because this kind of goes back to the debates that were going on last summer in the state legislature when they actually revived what some people are calling the Monsanto Protection Act, though I think that's kind of a narrow term for what they did, which was to ban ordinances like the one, or ban ballot measures like the one that you are going to be voting on next month in your county. But there was concern that we can't have a patchwork solution. We can't have patchwork bans of GMOs in some places and not in others. And so that's a concern. If you do pass your ballot measure to ban GMOs in Jackson County, how does that affect, let's say, the part of the Applegate Valley that's in Josephine County?
Well, I think that the real drive in getting so many people involved in this ballot measure is just the exact fear that our opposing side has, in their pleas for help and funding. They're saying, if this passes in Jackson County, this is going to spread throughout the state, possibly throughout the nation, and oh my, what could happen? So they see it as a real potential loss for them, and we see it as a real potential win for, the entire nation. So we're really, looking for support from outside to help us win.
Because they're getting support from outside, actually. The opponents are the outside.
Our county. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we know that the funding is unprecedented. The opponents for this measure, their goal by next week is to raise $500,000. They're currently at $375,000, and all of that is from out-of-state companies who obviously have a vested interest in this seed breeding that they're doing for genetically engineered sugar beets. So, we are really just very, have a good support of the people that live here, farm here, that hire employees here. So we're looking forward to winning the election for sure, and just educating people against the fear tactics that are coming out with all the money that they're raising.
Well, I want to talk a bit more about what is actually being grown, what kinds of seeds are being grown and developed in Jackson County, and how they can be affected specifically by GMO sugar beets.
Well, I mean, you're looking at just that family in particular with the sugar beets, but there's also corn being grown. Our neighbor is a conventional corn grower. He's been growing his corn for three generations. And, he boasts that his sweet corn is the best corn around, and I can't argue with him. It's terrific. And he's very concerned that this measure, if it's not passed, infringes on his property rights and does not allow him to grow, pure seed, and then he is at risk of growing a patented, seed that he didn't even pay for, and then getting a knock on his door like so many thousands of farmers have, saying that he, is at legal risk and is going to need to settle.
Okay, we got to explain that a little bit, because some people aren't going to understand. Well, first of all, if they're not growing GMO corn in Jackson County, how can his corn be contaminated?
Because there is GMO corn being grown here.
Okay, that answers that question. So then the next step is, why would he get a knock on the door? And this, we're assuming this is probably going to be Monsanto, because they're the big ones with GMO corn. It's Roundup Ready corn, basically, that you're talking about.
Right. So I just want to be clear that the majority of what is happening right now is little plots of land being leased out for sugar beet seed breeding.
And that's going to affect people who are growing chard and regular and non-GMO beets, and there's a few other leafy greens as well,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. So, but then you've also got alfalfa and corn being grown. And, there are other areas in the country and in the state that have protection against genetically engineered crops, because we know that it makes that crop unsellable. And not only is it unsellable, but then there's obviously the health risks that are involved. People don't really necessarily want to be growing genetically engineered crops. and then also the patent laws that they're at risk of violating. And that basically is about when you grow, when you decide that you want to grow a genetically engineered crop, you have to register with these large chemical companies. There's a whole onslaught of legal documents that you need to sign. And therefore, you have the right now to buy their seed, and that you must use their chemicals on your in your growing practices. So if you're not paying for that, then and you end up growing it because of contamination, which will happen from wind and from native pollinators, then you now are infringing on this big company's patent rights, because now you're growing their seed on your property, even though you didn't even want it to be grown there.
I think that, you know, the difficulty that it was really evidenced last spring when the GMO wheat plant was found in a farm on a field in eastern Oregon. And the farmer who discovered the plant and had it tested by OSU, he's remained anonymous, I guess, for a number of reasons. One of them being that Monsanto could have come after him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a chilling story. It was told very well in the film Food Inc., where it shows seed-saving farmers, I think, in Alberta or Saskatchewan, who were just, they not only saved their own seeds, but they cleaned their neighbor's seeds. And Monsanto was really coming down on them. I think right. At the end of the film, kind of won over them. So what you're doing seems like
a
preemptive.
We have a local wheat farmer who lost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on his wheat because it was unsellable, just because of the threat up in eastern Oregon. So it's, you know, it all pertains to all of us.
Right. Well, in that case with the wheat, it was because all the wheat shipped out of the port of Portland. And we have friends in Tangent who have a very, very large grass seed farm. They grow organic grains. They also grow some conventional wheat for export. And their shipment was held up. Well, fortunately, they didn't harvest until the markets opened. But they were looking at the possibility of 900 acres of white soft white wheat being unsaleable. And
right.
So it wasn't that it was directly contaminated by this single plant
right,
in eastern.
The
but for export, it's all commingled. And so whether it's coming up from Jackson County or coming up from out from Grant County or from Linn County, it's all winds up in the same pot.
Right. And so it's just the threat alone has, you know, stopped these sales from happening or postponed them to so much to a point that people are losing the crop.
Now, are people in your county also concerned about GMOs in terms of health as well as market problems?
Of course. Definitely.
So what are some of their health concerns?
You know, I can't really address everyone's individual health concerns, and that's not really part of our campaign messaging as much because we're really focusing on the contamination threat. We're focusing on, you know, property rights and really protecting family farms. You know, as a person who grows food, obviously I'm concerned, and I feel like it's my right to not have my food contaminated with genetically engineered crops. When I don't choose to eat them.
So it seems like it's an interesting coalition of organic and conventional farmers that are banding together to support
exactly.
your initiative.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's any farmer who's not growing genetically engineered seed is really what it's all about. And that's been really great to have, you know, people unite that maybe have been on different thoughts and then really coming together on this measure saying, you know, this is not okay with us to let these, you know, huge chemical companies come in and take over our right to grow what we want to grow and put our livelihood as farmers at stake.
Well, what are some of your role model counties in California been doing since their initiatives passed? What are some of the lessons that could be learned both from people who are advocates for your ballot measure as well as people in your county who are right now opposing the ballot measure?
Well, I think the biggest thing to look at that is very reassuring is that, you know, there are lots of, you know, like five counties that actually have a measure in place. There's three that are very similar to ours in California, and all of those measures have had no cost, if not maybe like a phone call once a year. I think it was in Marin County, and so that is very reassuring for the public to know that we're not looking at a big cost to implement this. And, you know, why is there such great compliance is because, you know, these people have to sign a legal document to grow genetically engineered seeds. So, you know, who is going to sign a legal document when it's illegal in that county. And so that really is helpful, I think, for people to realize and know that, you know, even though they're hearing maybe from the opponents that, you know, the same as they did with all the labeling laws, you know, just scaring people with the cost. We have real, you know, history. Marin County for over 10 years has had this measure in place. All they've seen happen is that their agricultural sales have just, you know, been booming 10 times the amount and they're, you know, than they had before. So all of that is looking really positive. It's just keeping people educated on the fact that, you know, the opposing sides are funded by these chemical companies, and, you know, they are doing everything they can, and they're really, you know, taking drastic measures to kind of scare the public into thinking there's going to be a big cost from the measure being passed, which is completely false. So,
well,
just getting out there, educating, educating.
I want to also maybe compare, or see if you can compare your situation to Mendocino County, which I think is economically a little bit closer to Jackson County. I mean, Marin County is one of the wealthiest counties in the country. So,
right.
Yeah, so they can do anything because they have the money. But Mendocino County is, I mean, besides the little enclave of Mendocino, which has some wealth to it, it's a pretty working class farming community, farming, logging, very rural community, and probably has an economic demographic similar to Jackson County. So what has been their experience having a GMO ban there?
So their experience is the cost of enforcing the county's restrictions from genetically engineered crops was negligible. They said it was very minimal. There's a few complaints they receive. It says nearly all can be or usually handled over the phone. Only about a complaint a year may require an on-site visit. And that was quoted, from the Mendocino County representative. And their county is actually 40% bigger than ours. So you think if they only have, you know, one phone call a year they have to deal with, I think we're doing pretty well.
So this is basically complaint-driven, and
And that's the way the measure is written, is that the county has discretion on whether they want to enforce it or not. And so the county can choose not to enforce this at all, that it's not within their budget, and they can choose to not support us as farmers, which is fine. But at least me as a farmer, I can take legal action myself if need be. And so that really protects me as a farmer.
And you are a farmer, right?
I am, yes. Yeah, we have 113 acres in the Applegate Valley.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Elise Higley, farmer and campaign director for Family Farms Measure, which is a ballot measure that's going to be voted on in May this year in Jackson County to ban the production, the growth, or raising GMO crops. Now, let's talk about some of the exceptions, because actually in your fine print, it's like it bans most GMO crops, but there were some exceptions.
Well, the exceptions were in a contained environment, so we're not trying to stop scientific research, but we are trying to stop contamination for crops and for open pollination happening. So, you know, that is part of that we don't want people to think that we're trying to, you know, completely stop it, but it doesn't work for the Rogue Valley, and it doesn't work to be in an open field and having test plots with no regulation.
So if they did it, let's say, in a greenhouse that had no ventilation to the outside, that might be...
Right. The USDA has restrictions and requirements on all of those things that are written in law.
Well, you were talking to me last night about a pinning map that you were trying to develop at one point that would have shown, basically be a big map of the county, and every plot where there was going to be a genetically engineered crop grown, there'd be a pin on it. And that's been a suggestion. That's the suggestion in the Willamette Valley that has been in place with sugar beet, GMO sugar beet growing there for the last number of years. And organic farmers actually complain that it doesn't really help. But in the pinning map, so you would the GMO crops would be pinned, and then the organic farmers would know how much buffer they needed to have in order to grow their crops, and or even the non GMO farmers would know how far they had to grow their crops away from the GMO crops. Well, what happened with this whole idea of the pinning map?
Well, it's not about just genetically engineered seed growers pinning. It was about anybody pinning on the map who grows seed. And so that started in January of last year, the Southern Oregon Seed Growers Association. I'm sure that they would be happy to speak with you as well. We, our members, But basically, they started these meetings and talked about, looked at what other areas are doing for their mapping system, and came up with a system that seemed fair and just for all farmers being represented. And when in the fifth month coming in, when the pinning process was actually coming to place, the months before, Syngenta had sent one of their representatives. They didn't send any farmers because that we know of, I mean, there's not the farmers themselves. It's really this chemical company leasing out plots of land. So they're actually coming in and planting the seed and then pulling it out. So they came in, and then on the fifth month, they sent their lawyer in and said that they were not going to be transparent with where their crops are being planted, and that this wasn't part of their business model, and didn't choose to cooperate with us.
And what does that mean to you, that they don't want to be transparent about where their crops are being planted?
Basically, they just don't want to tell us where they're planting. So that's, you know, we're not able to know. I mean, we can, you know, you can kind of drive by and guesstimate, but you really don't know unless you're talking, you know, with them directly. So basically, we're all at risk because we don't know where they are.
It seems like if you're trying to develop a good neighbor policy, if they're trying to win over the county so that the county will support the growth of GMO sugar beet seeds in Jackson County, that you wouldn't be untransparent. Wouldn't you think that they'd try some way to at least appear to be building trust?
You would think a good neighbor would be talking with their neighbors and working it out. But the problem is, we're talking about a company who's all about getting money. They're not there to look after you know, the other farmers. They're there to look out for themselves. And so this is what happens when you're dealing with you know, companies like that, that really there's no heart involved with it. It's just about them.
I was actually
making the most money they can.
I was listening back to an interview I did with David James Duncan the other day, where he was talking about the whole idea of corporation is the idea of corporate personhood, which is a person without any civic or human responsibility or any heart or any soul. It's just a big pile of money. And
right.
I think that we're seeing that with Syngenta. Now, people, when they think about GMO, they usually just talk about Monsanto. So what is the lesson for you down in Jackson County when you're really dealing with Syngenta, probably, and not very much with Monsanto? That what does it show you as far as what the real problem is and how many companies are actually involved?
You know, I don't necessarily know the answer to that question. I just know that there's a real concern when somebody patents a product that is, you know, infringing on other people's rights. And that's where I have a big issue as a farmer. I feel like, you know, what I do on my property and what other people do on their property, they have the right to do. But when it goes over the boundary of my property line and puts another farm at risk of losing their place, and that cannot be tolerated. And that's really, you know, what I feel is kind of unarguable at that point.
Well, compared to the three counties in California that have anti-GMO ordinances now, I always consider Jackson County to be a little bit more on the conservative side politically, and that Jackson County's kind of seen, with the exception of a few little enclaves like around Ashland and maybe parts of the Applegate Valley, that it's a long history of being really very conservative on a whole lot of social and economic issues. So how is this playing in Jackson County, and how much support are you seeing from the general population, all those people who probably belong to the Tea Party and people who have been involved in anti-gay initiatives in the past? Are you finding that you're bringing them along as well?
Definitely. I think people are really concerned that this is an infringement on people's rights. And we have people from, you know, all sides that are for the measure. So it's that part is really good to see, that people can see past this is not a political measure. This is about you know, preserving our farmland in our valley and in our county.
Now, what kind of objections are you hearing in the county to your measure from different quarters, whether it's the county commission or whether it's the newspaper or whether it's Syngenta ads?
Yeah, so the thing that you will see on their website is the cost, is what they're claiming one of our administrators reports to be a fact, when in fact The county administrator didn't even interview or talk with, or at least he didn't report his findings on his report of any of the three counties that have a similar measure in place. So, you know, the fact that it was so misrepresented and it was so politically driven was quite obvious. And then, of course, they're claiming that this is going to affect our medical marijuana industry.
Now, how is it going to do that? That's a good question.
And it absolutely isn't. There's not genetically engineered marijuana seed. So, you know, to even claim that, it's obviously that they're just so desperate. They're reaching to divide, you know, divide people. And
so they're trying to get the hippies afraid? Is that get the hippies on their side?
I don't even think it's the hippies. I think it's people that are, you know, growing medical marijuana. They're trying to get them afraid. And that's their tactic, is to they took a poll, and they found out from their poll, which is no surprise, that people react, a knee-jerk reaction to the fear of cost rising for themselves or fear of losing money. And so that's their tactic. They're going to go after fear. And so, you know, our side is that we just need to educate people on the truth. And, you know, we know that the Jackson County is smarter and can see past, you know, where the money's actually coming from and why it's here.
Well, besides the marijuana growers, are there other farmers that they're trying to reach out to with tactics that would frighten them into opposing your measure?
The other tactics are saying that, you know, to local stores and shops that items would be pulled off their shelves, they would be losing money, you know, they wouldn't be able to sell Roundup anymore or you know, feed that's got GMOs in it, which is obviously not what's happening. What's happening is this is about cultivation and propagation of genetically engineered plants. So
it's not about labeling, it's not about selling.
This is like such a baby step. This is so little. This is saying you just can't grow this in this valley that's so narrow and windy, because no matter what you do, unless it's in a covered environment, a contained environment, you are going to contaminate your neighbor's farm up to 4 miles away. And our valley is not that wide. So it's preserving our right to farm how we want to. Basically, if we allow genetically engineered farming to continue here, we're giving up our right to have pure seed.
Well, I'm thinking back to the GMO labeling campaigns, the ballot measures in California last year, Washington just a few months ago, that had amazing amounts of money poured in. Mainly Syngenta was one of the companies, Monsanto, of course, Bayer, Dow, which I think people don't even think of Bayer and Dow
as
being...
The same.
Yeah, they're all the same company.
Same people right. Pouring money into this.
Yeah, and Bayer doesn't just make aspirin. They are one of the major genetically modified crop developers in the world. And so both of these measures, and they had the same arguments being made against them in these very expensive ads that were broadcast all over the states. Basically, it's going to cost you a lot of money. It's going to limit your freedom. It's things that sounds like the same arguments that are being made by you. I'm wondering, what do you think is more controversial, GMO labeling of food or banning the growing of GMO crops?
I mean, honestly, I think both of them are a no-brainer. I don't know, you know, so I don't see why it is difficult to label food, whether it's genetically engineered or not. So I'm just appalled that that is even an argument.
But I'm concerned that if they threw so much money at stopping GMO labeling from happening, which should just be a right to know, which I think is in our Constitution, or if
exactly.
It isn't, should be, but something like it is in the Constitution. But the... But what you're doing actually seems one step further. You're saying we're not going to allow it to be grown in the state. Now, it seems to me that's a bigger threat, and I'm wondering if they're going to throw even more money at your campaign.
Well, I mean, you can look at the money that's come in and put things in comparison. So when they hit $175,000, which now I think they're at $375,000.
They being the opponents, right?
Yeah, so when the opponents had raised $175,000 last month or whatever that was, at that point, they had raised more money than any other, than all ballots in the history of Jackson County put together. So now they're at $375,000. So, you know, this is, and then their argument is that it's hurting our local budget. Well, tell me how Bayer cares about our local Jackson County's budget. They don't care about that. You know, this is completely political driven off of money that they want to make outside of our county. And, you know, we just need, like I said, we just need to trust that people are going to hear the message. And that's the beauty that we have in a smaller measure like this. You know, we are the people that live, eat, work, breathe, you know, play here. So we are talking to our neighbors. You know, you'll see signs up all over. I mean, everybody I talk to is supportive of the measure. The only people that I talk to that have heard from other people have been misled. And once they understand the truth behind it, they're like, oh, okay, I didn't understand that, you know. And then they're completely supportive, and they're voting yes on 15-119, yes to protect the family farms, protect our future, all the good stuff that we're looking for to have in this county.
Well, when I do these my informal polling to sort of tell whether a measure is going to pass, I go by lawn signs, which are sometimes pretty accurate, not always, but they often can tell you an awful lot about how a community is thinking. And I'm wondering, how is the lawn sign campaign going?
The lawn sign campaign is going great. I mean, we have hundreds out already. And we are, you know, our farmers markets in Jackson County are all GMO-free. So we've been, every member is not allowed to even sell genetically engineered crops in our farmers market. So obviously people who are shopping, you know, the thousands of people that shop at our market are all in support of this measure. And so it's just really getting out there and educating. So those signs are flying out at farmers market as well. So.
And how about the other side? Are you seeing any no on your measure?
I have not seen any. I've heard that there's a billboard or something up, and I've heard that there's a lot of radio ads. But, I mean, of course, what are you going to spend $500,000 on? You better spend it on something, right?
Oh, yeah, I guess. Well, if you're just tuning in.
Too bad they didn't put that in our local economy.
Right. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about a ballot measure that's being voted on in May in Jackson County to ban the propagation, cultivation of GMO crops, particularly, sugar beets is one, which is a bigger one, but I guess anything that can contaminate the thriving seed business that's been going on in Jackson County for a long time. And I'm talking with Elise Higley, who's the campaign director for Family Farms Measure, which is the group behind or supporting and campaigning for the ballot measure. In the remaining moments, I want to talk a little bit about the larger political landscape in Oregon. That's sort of the background for your initiative. When this initiative started, and this I understand is before you actually came on the campaign, there were initiatives being planned in several different counties, particularly Lane and Benton County, that would have been very similar and also banned GMO crops. The one in Benton County, though, went on to also declare that corporations could not have the same rights as people, and that was thrown out. They were thrown out for the having more than one subject in the ballot measure. And then the initiatives in Benton County and Lane County got nipped in the bud by legislation last summer that banned any more anti-GMO ordinances around the state. But they grandfathered the one that's going on in Jackson County. So I'm curious, first of all, do you know why they grandfathered yours in? You were able to get is it just that the process was too far to pull it back?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, our signatures were already turned in, and we were already approved before that Senate bill went through.
Because I find it kind of interesting that if your measure passes, what do you think the implications are going to be for the rest of the state?
Well, we're really hoping that this will give people a power and the push to move forward and to know it's possible. And I think that is why the opposing side is so scared.
Well, if you do get passed...
When we get past.
Okay, when you get past it, okay. when this measure becomes law in Jackson County, what happens to those people in the Applegate Valley who live in Josephine County? How are they, I mean, is this going to help them at all, or are they still going to be a danger of, does Syngenta also have farm plots there?
Yeah, you might want to call Josephine County, because they have it on their ballot this election as well.
They do? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it the same as yours? It has to be obviously different. You're different counties.
It's a little bit different, yeah.
So but they weren't mentioned as being grandfathered in with the state legislation last summer. So how do they sneak in?
So So you talk to them about it. It's super exciting stuff. Yeah.
But they're getting they're not getting very much publicity. I mean, Omid Oregon, for example, which I think brought your initiative to the attention of Oregonians all around the state. I mean, they've definitely been promoting, supporting your initiative, but I haven't heard anything from them about Josephine County.
Yeah, give them a call. Give them a call. And they definitely need all the support they can get as well. I mean, we're supporting any farmer who does not want genetically engineered crops being grown in their area. We feel like it's the, you know, the right to every farmer to be able to fight that. So, yeah, definitely.
So at the same time, what do you think is going to happen, or do you have any idea what might happen in Benton County and Lane County, where they were basically forbidden from trying to get their ballots, their initiatives on the ballot?
I mean, I think once this passes, it's going to give people a vehicle to move forward and find ways to get this through everywhere.
Because one of the arguments that was made, and this is an argument that Kitzhoffer made against the local initiatives, is that he thought that having just a patchwork of ordinances and lack of ordinances around the state relating to growing GMO crops would cause a lot of confusion. It can cause contamination across county borders. As, for instance, if Benton County had a ban and Linn County doesn't, and you live right close to the border in Benton County, you're still going to get contaminated by Linn County. So,
well, we already have. You know, bans or limits to certain crops already in certain areas, in certain counties, because we know that how much it affects the marketability of that product. When you look at areas in California and also in Oregon where they're protected, like with from canola. So it's, you know, it's happening because it's so detrimental to the sellability of a crop. It really puts us out of the international market altogether. And then you look at big companies, you know, look at Grape Nuts and Cheerios. I mean, some really mainstream companies are saying they want to be genetically engineered free. So if you, you know, to limit, farming is hard enough as it is. And, you know, we don't need more, you know, restrictions and to make it hard to make a living until the possibility of losing our land. So we need all the help we can get, and we definitely don't need to be at jeopardy of losing our place because of what somebody else chooses to plant miles down the road.
Actually, I know a grass seed farmer in Tangent who is very concerned about growing canola because they almost lifted the ban against canola in the Willamette Valley. Mm-hmm. And he was concerned because so many grass seed farmers wanted to use canola as a rotation crop. And he pointed out that in Germany, which used to be the leading producer of cool season grass seed, which is what the Linn County is now the leader in, and Germany lost their ability to raise grass seed because of all the canola contamination. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the Willamette Valley is, and the Rogue River Valley, and probably several other valleys in western Oregon, are kind of the last bastion of relative GMO-free farmland. And I'm wondering if you see that this is one of the reasons why Syngenta and the other companies have their eyes on us, because we're the holdouts.
Exactly. Yeah, they're just trying to see how much, you know, how badly we're going to fight for our land.
So do you see that after the victory in May that you might take this statewide, either as a statewide initiative or as working with the governor?
I'm going to be happily farming. I'm not really in politics. I'm doing this because I feel like my farm's at jeopardy if it doesn't pass. And that's why so many farmers have gotten involved, even though we're so busy on our farms. And that's why, you know, we do what we love to do is farming. But at some point you kind of look up and think, okay, there's been people, you know, GMO-free Jackson County spent 2 years getting this ballot going, this measure going on, getting it on the ballot. It's time for farmers to step up and have their voice be heard. Otherwise, you know, we may just think, oh my gosh, what just happened? And so that's really why we've gotten more involved, because we feel like our, you know, our farms are at risk.
What would you like to see from people up here in the Portland area as far as support goes in the remaining weeks before the election?
We would love for you to get on our website. It's ourfamilyfarmscoalition.org. Any money contributions that you can kick in, every $250 we get is another commercial we can air. Just signing on as a supporter is just so wonderful to have, you know, more and more people sign on, showing their support. We definitely appreciate it. So,
and we have links to both the GMO-free Jackson County website, and actually we have links to the Family Farms Coalition website, and also to your Facebook page, so people can get information either way.
Great.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Elise. It's been great talking with you. Good luck with the campaign.
So
And we'll check in after the election, see how things are going.
Exactly. Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks a lot. So we've been talking this morning with Elise Higley, who's campaign director for the Family Farms Measure in Jackson County, Southern Oregon, a measure to ban GMO crops from being cultivated or propagated. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week I'll be gone, but we'll be rebroadcasting last spring's interview with Eric Dinnerstein, author of The Kingdom of Rarities. I'll be back in 2 weeks when my guest will be George Bash, who's with the Himalayan Stove Project. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Sting. Thanks for listening.
To co-sponsor The Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at The Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at The Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of kboo.fm under Community Events.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Washington County Cooperative Library Service's 10th Annual Storytelling Festival, Art of the Story. The festival features five professional storytellers: Bill Lepp from South Charleston, West Virginia; Alton Takeyama Chung from Vancouver, Washington; Olga Loya from San Jose, California; Will Horniak from Portland, Oregon; and Habiba Addo from Portland, Oregon and Ghana, West Africa. The week-long storytelling extravaganza features 14 storytelling performances at various locations, including the Washington County Member Libraries, the Glenn and Viola Walters Cultural Arts Center, and the Washington County Museum in Hillsboro. That's the 10th Annual Storytelling Festival, April 5th through 12th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And coming up next at 11 o'clock, which is just a few seconds away, we will honor the birthday of farm worker and labor leader Cesar Chavez by broadcasting Flight of the Eagle. That's a documentary on the United Farm Workers Union. It is 11 a.m. and you are tuned to KBOO in Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. And now, Flight of the Eagle.
The The Flight of the Eagle, the United Farm Workers Union, a Pacifica radio documentary.
I'm Brian DeShazer, and welcome to From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series that brings history out of the vault and back on the radio. That was the voice of Chuy Varela, and he will be the narrator on this week's From the Vault, as we rebroadcast his 1995 Pacifica documentary on the history of the United Farm Workers Union, produced using Pacifica Radio Archives material. Here is The Flight of the Eagle.
In pristine, brightly lit supermarkets, the fruits and vegetables that make up our diet are displayed in boxed or bagged packages covered in cellophane or plastic. Open produce is sprayed and misted to preserve its shelf life and color. Apples, oranges, tomatoes, cucumbers sit there for the discretion of anxious consumers to poke, touch, smell, and squeeze for quality and value. It's that value that determines what shoppers buy. But few know how produce gets to their supermarket shelves, and fewer yet know how that cents per pound breaks down from the market to the grower to the farm worker. In this country, agriculture is a multi-billion dollar industry, yet the relationship between agribusiness and those that cultivate and harvest the crops is a sad history of greed and exploitation. American labor history has countless examples of resistance and organizing by farm workers who risked everything to hopefully improve their condition. The idea of organizing farm workers was first tried around the turn of the century by the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world. Ultimately, they failed, but they ignited a spark that others followed into World War II when labor shortages started the importation of guest workers from Mexico. It wasn't until the 1960s, at the height of the civil rights movement, that a charismatic young Chicano named Cesar Chavez appeared in the fields of one of the richest farm belts in the country and sparked a burning desire to organize this marginalized workforce that would change farm labor forever. It was like David taking on Goliath. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Delano grape strike, which launched Cesar Chavez and his union to the national limelight. As the National Farm Workers Association, they unveiled a flag which consisted of a huge black Aztec eagle with a white circular background on a bright red rectangular piece of cloth at its founding convention in Fresno in 1962. That flag has been the beacon that has changed how agribusiness looks at farm workers. In this Pacifica documentary, we'll profile the beginnings of what is now the United Farm Workers Union and the impact of this landmark Delano grape strike of 1965.
Después de dos semanas para unirse a la batalla salieron los mexicanos. Juntos vamos cumpliendo con la marcha de la historia para liberar el pueblo. ¡Viva la revolución! ¡Arriba con nuestra unión! ¡Viva huelga en general! ¡Viva la huelga en el fin! ¡Viva la causa en la historia! ¡La raza llena de gloria!
I don't know how much you folks know about organizing, but an organizer is always searching for a man among men, for a man that feels a thing so deeply and so strongly and so intensely that once he gets into it, he just can't help but eat and sleep and breathe organizing.
Fred Ross taught Cesar Chavez how to organize. Their paths crossed in the 1950s in San Jose, California, when Chavez was working as a lumber handler and living in the poor neighborhood known as Sal Si Puedes, Get Out If You Can. He was 25 and impressed with the aspiration of the community service organization in its effort to organize Mexican Americans. He went to work for the CSO and through Ross was introduced to the organizing methods of Saul Alinsky. Soon he was traveling throughout rural California, putting together CSO chapters. In 1958, he was assigned to Oxnard, California, near Los Angeles. Once settled, he organized house meetings, voter registration, and citizenship classes. He started to hear the same complaint. The braceros were taking jobs away. The bracero program was implemented during World War II to augment U.S. labor shortages. A contract agreement was reached with Mexico to provide thousands of workers to the agricultural sectors of the Southwest. They lived under very bad conditions in migrant camps and in certain places were not allowed to mix with the general population. In the mid-1960s, the program was just benefiting a powerful few. Chavez argued and convinced growers in Oxnard that there were workers there willing to work if given the chance. After organizing a CSO chapter, Chavez started a hiring hall and made good in the workers' eyes.
I saw him in operation for many years. I worked right beside him for the last 2 years. Then I knew the wonderful job he did organizing farm workers by himself over in Oxnard, the first real thrust that had been made against citrus over there and against the growers in that area. After that, and after seeing him in operation heading up the whole CSO movement in this state, there wasn't any question in my mind but what he was certainly the best Mexican-American organizer in the United States.
Chavez worked 12 years with the CSO and attempted to form a farm workers union through the organization, but his attempts were rejected, and in March of 1962, he quit. He recruited Dolores Huerta and Gilberto Padilla from the CSO and returned to Delano to start the union. The idea was that workers had to realize that organizing collectively was the way out of their misery, as Chavez explains.
In my 12 or so years working under Alinsky and Fred Ross, I had learned one thing, and that is that anywhere you go, you will find a small group of people, whether it be students or university professors or farm workers, who are already interested enough to do something about the problem that confronts them. So on this basis, I went, and in order to build the beginning or the foundations of the association, I visited something like 85 small communities, including labor camps, and was thus able to form the nucleus of the Farm Workers Association. When I look back on the beginning of that work, it seems like we've gone a long ways. And of course, when I look forward, it seems like we haven't moved hardly anything or anywhere.